Integrity and experience that is often lacking in the precious metals business. Let her put it to work for you. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70, and worldwide on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Roll away the dawn, roll away the dawn, and let me see the land of the free. Has anything changed at home? Sweet liberty.
Listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This isn't Jackie, it's Alan, in case you're wondering. I joked with Jackie earlier that maybe the spray's affecting everybody and we're getting too much hormonal treatment coming from the skies. But no, it's me, Alan Watt, who's standing in. And today is the 30th of May, 2005. And I think it's the end of the Memorial Day in the United States of America. In Canada, we had our version of the same thing a couple of weeks ago. And it was rather sad to see all the footage from the World War One and Two, and then the Korean War, excerpts which had never been shown to the public before, because it would have been bad for morale, as they say. And what you see are battlefields just full of bodies from the First World War, lying in formation as they went over the trenches, just dropping in line. One row after another, and no one could ever persuade me that the generals did not know how to fight this war, and so they just continued for 2 or 3 years, sending regiment after regiment up into machine gun fire. This was definitely a population reduction program, which really worked very, very well for them. Every memorial, every town and village across the length and breadth of Britain has these monuments with thousands of names on them of people that were often your ancestors, just wiped out at the age of 17 and 18. My grandfather went to World War One at the age of 15. He lied to get in. So it's just incredible to watch the techniques used by the big powers to get us into battles and wars. They can lie to us so we think we know what we're fighting for, but we never really do. It's not until 50 years later or more that we find out what the real reasons of the wars were, what the real motives were, who benefited from them. And of course, the history of warfare goes back for many, many thousands of years using the same techniques. And when money was first introduced by the Minoans, who lived in the Aegean Sea, the Minoans are the precursors of the Phoenicians, and very probably they were the same people, simply using different names down through time. The Minoans lived in beautiful islands in the Aegean Sea. We know that because some of the remains of their buildings are still there. And they had every room painted, hand-painted in fresco art, which is still beautiful today. These Minoans owned the shipping lines of their day, the caravan routes across the Middle East, and elsewhere. They owned basically the whole economy of the old ancient world, and they lived a life of luxury in their Aegean islands. They also had a connection to Egypt, and we know that from the frescoes which we can see on the walls, where the young boys' curls come down to the sides of their cheeks, which is a sign of youth, and the Egyptians used the same symbols for theirs, and very probably they used the same artists to do the frescoes. But these Minoans left very little to us by knowledge, except that they, apart from their luxurious lifestyles and their command of the trade routes, they also created factory towns wherever they went. They would take over gradually through the introduction of money, which at that time was weighed. And we can find the same weighing of money going back to the Sumer. The same scales were used, the same weights and measures were used. And these ancient merchant bankers literally were standardizing the weight and measure system across the old ancient world. And when they took over a town or village by the introduction of money and then the gradual lending of money, which led to interest, which then led to bankruptcy, they took over those little areas, put their own men in as tyrants, and created factory towns, and then had everyone working, producing things to pay off the debt. And this was going on 4,000 BC, and probably longer. We know, for instance, that the Egyptians traded with them. We also know that the people in the Levant areas traded with them. And we know that they had an island, Bahrain, which that was their halfway place, where they brought in all of their goodies to sell, and they could defend that little island. And that way it was like a bank unto itself, heavily defended. And even the Sumerian tablets show us that the island they had off Bahrain was called Dilmun, heavily fortified, and the people themselves in Sumer did not know where all the goods actually came from at that time, but it's thought they were actually being brought over from somewhere in India. So we're looking at a tremendous trading society in ancient times, run by a small group of people who introduced money everywhere they went. They introduced debt systems wherever they went. They introduced, gradually through bankruptcies, slavery systems wherever they went. And then we're given no reason as to why they disappeared. Their symbol, their main religious symbol, as far as we know, was a battle axe. And it's the battle axe, of course, we eventually see showing up as the fasci of the Romans much, much later. But in between that time and the Romans, they changed their name to Phoenicians and moved in to that area, which is now called the Holy Land, and they ran their trading routes from that area. We know that the Phoenicians did kill their firstborn in times of trouble. They'd sacrifice their firstborn children. Only the nobility did this. And thousands and thousands of urns have been dug up, unearthed underneath the temples, where they buried the remains of these burned children. And it's quite fascinating to see the same symbology eventually go into the Old Testament. Because there's hints, lots of hints, at old Jehovah demanding the firstborn of every creature. And no matter how much has been scrubbed and polished, we can still get traces of that thing happening within what we think of as the Hebrew people. However, getting back to the money situation, the money was the key to pretty well all of the world's problems 5000 BC and onwards. Without money, you could not hire an army or train it or hold it and then send it off abroad to fight for maybe years. And so whoever created the money ruled the army. And what we find is an ongoing succession of countries becoming empires by the introduction of money, living quite happily with slavery systems as part of their system, and we see them attacking countries which did not use their money and would not allow the debt system to come in. They'd simply use countries they'd taken over to invade them and then enforce it on the people. And this went on as they built up empire after empire. The Greek Empire, which preceded the Roman Empire, was had a huge effect on the ancient world. Alexander the Great, although he was Macedonian, and the Macedonians, by the way, their language is directly descended from the Phoenician Phoenician tongue. Alexander, who'd been trained by Aristotle, who'd been trained by Plato, and then going back a whole bunch of trainers prior to that, went back to Egypt, because these were the Egyptian mysteries which were being exported abroad. And we find that Aristotle was sent out as a fisher king to train revolutionaries to take over more and more of the world. So everything that came out of Egypt always ended up with people, students, setting up elsewhere and causing revolutions. Revolutions being the key to the great work, as they called it, of taking over the world and making everything one. So Aristotle also was married to one of these international bankers of his day. His wife was the niece of one of the biggest international banker who lived in the so-called area of the Holy Land. So he trained Alexander to be a warrior. He trained him in the mysteries, and he trained them to lead men, and he also trained them to that he was a god, you see. Because in all the mystery religions, when you work through them, you end up finding out, my God, you're a god yourself. And Alexander did what he was told and trained to do, and he took over a good part of Asia and the Holy Land, of course, and Egypt as well. And he was heavily funded from the banks back in his own country and the banks of Greece. And when he died, he left a couple of his generals who started dynasties in the countries which had been taken over. So Ptolemy ended up taking over Egypt and becoming a pharaoh. So the latter Greeks were not Egyptian. The latter pharaohs were not Egyptian. They were actually Greek, right down to Cleopatra. So they had a tremendous import and export business in the ancient world when the Greeks ran it. And when eventually it became too hot for the Greeks, the elites moved and created Rome. And even though we always think of the Romans as speaking the old Latin language, the elite of Rome, through their entire empire era, spoke Greek amongst themselves, because they were descended from the elite of Greece, who all claimed to be the descendants of gods. The Romans, of course, you'll find in any history book that the Roman elite did exactly the same, because they were the same people, and they even dedicated temples to themselves while alive, and the people could go and worship their statue there as an actual deity, a god. Constantine, even after he'd officially accepted Christianity, he himself was a member of the Mithraic cult, which was a mystery religion, and others. And he, in his lifetime after 365 AD, he also set up a temple where people could go and worship his likeness, his deity. Christianity did not put an end to the mystery religion. It was still working in the open in 365 AD and afterwards. The obelisks that you see in Egypt were a symbol. Each one was a symbol for some aristocracy member having reached a great height in the mystery religions, and the obelisk was the phallic symbol of apotheosis, attaining godhood, having the power of a god. And it was always shown with the virile obelisk symbol. And that could even be used for a female. Cleopatra had one for her, and other Egyptian queens prior to her. You'll find these obelisks, these phallic symbols from Egypt, were taken. Some of them were taken to Rome. One was set up in the circus. Constantine had his son go and fetch them, which is a great job in itself. And then, of course, in about the 1700s, the Pope of that day had it moved to St. Peter's Square outside the Vatican. France also had one, which they put outside their Parliament building. Another one was taken and sent to London, where it stands on the banks of the Thames, faced by the four major banks that rule Britain. So another one was taken from Egypt and ended up in the park outside New York, still there. And we wonder why would brand new countries send off to Egypt for obelisk symbols in an era of supposed Christianity. And if what it tells you is the mystery religion not only coexists with Christianity, it claims to have created the religion of Christianity, and that it is behind it, in fact. so these obelisks were brought from a place which had an empire, a world empire of its time, Egypt, and placed around the world in other areas. There was also one taken to Constantinople, where Justinian ruled the Catholic Church at that time. The only new one which was built on any scale was the one to George Washington. And we have to look at that very carefully, because why in the supposed, what we're told, that all these Christians fighting for their new country and no king but Jesus, etc., etc., in the propaganda that we read coming out and afterwards of that era, why would they erect an obelisk to George Washington? And then the reason, of course, is George Washington was a member not only of the British royal families, as you can find from Burke's Peerage, the official Queen's genealogist, but most of the big figures that we know of that signed the Declaration of Independence were terribly high Masons, Freemasons of that era. In the modern Masonic books, they boast about the fact that they've been behind revolutions, that they gave us the national and international education system, and they do the planning for the future. Now, obviously, these aren't the little Masons on your street corner. These are the lower Freemasons who think they know what they belong to, but in the words of Albert Pike, who was the high chutzpah of the southern jurisdiction, he was a Grand Master, he was actually called the Pope of Freemasonry. He said, for the lower Masons, he said, it's not necessary that they understand what the symbols mean. It's only necessary that they think they understand, because Freemasonry does not end at the 32nd and then the 33rd honorary degree. It goes way beyond that, and there are much, much higher sects, and then you get into the noble lineages, the knightly images, aristocratic Freemasonry, where you now get into the real stuff, what's really going on, and you'll find that these aristocracies and these nobilities can trace their lineages back for thousands of years. And they only intermarry through the advice of the high priests, who match them up genealogically with their wives so that they can maintain, as they say, the perfect breeding. In the newspapers over the last few years, they've been quite honest, especially in the British newspapers, to inform us who these presidents are, and the running mates too. And you'll generally find that both of them are related to the royal families. John Kerry had more connections, bloodline connections in the royal families of Europe than did George Bush, and he has plenty enough. So what we're looking at here are families who've been involved in huge business and banking going back for many, many thousands of years, right down into, as I say, ancient Greece and even Egypt. When we look at Prince Charles, he made the famous statement that he not only goes back to the lineage of David, but he goes back to the days of Noah. Now, supposedly these people are quite sane, so that newspapers tell us, and yet they come out with these statements without any qualification to the public, and we let it pass, even though they say it with a straight face. But when you really do the digging, you'll find they're telling the truth, at least to the fact that they can trace their lineages back for thousands and thousands of years. So if we go back to the Minoans, the earliest merchant bankers who owned the shipping lines, the ships themselves, and the trading routes going all the way to China, and then passing it on to the Phoenicians, and then again the building up of the Grecian Empire, which then promoted it further and created a larger empire than the Roman Empire, which took over a good part of the world. What we're seeing is a step-by-step enlargement of empires till eventually they've got to where they are now, which is the final step towards world empire. And the people who are up there in charge of all this have descendancies going back, all the way back to all the ancient famous people of ancient history. That is not a coincidence. It's impossible to be a coincidence. These people are literally specially bred through their mating up of their partners to do exactly what they're doing. And if we jump even further back to Plato of Greece, who lived around 2,350 years ago, Plato laid out the agenda for world empire in a book called The Republic. And if we give some background on Plato, he, like all of his the aristocracy, claimed direct descendancy from the gods. He was trained in the Grecian mysteries. He then went off to do his studies, like most of them did, in Egypt, and then he left and to go to the Middle East, which is basically Jerusalem. And from then on, from studying the mysteries there, he then went to India and then completed his course there and came back to Greece, where he did exactly what all those before him had done. He started his own mystery school up, where he recruited the youth, and he taught the youth the methods of governance, of how to change the world, the direction they were to change the world in, the reasons for it, and sometimes to create revolutions. So he also talked in the Republic of this perfect world state to come, where the guardian class, as he called it, which today we'd say were the aristocracy, most of whom we never hear about and see in public. These guardian classes have been here forever. And Plato said that they would have complete and total rule over the perfect world state. He said they were specially bred for intellect. They were specially bred to have sensitivity and with intellect, but not softness, as he called it, meaning they would not be terribly forgiving. And then he likened it to the ways that animals had been bred already for thousands of years. He said we can breed domesticated animals with certain traits. And he mentioned the dogs, different variety of dogs. Some were bred with other dogs to create vicious types for guard dogs. Some were bred for higher intelligence, like the sheepdogs and so on. So he said we can do the same with people. Now, when he said that, you also get the clue that the guardian class that he's talking about have also been bred for that position. They can be ruthless when required. They can use intelligence, most certainly. They're cunning. But they have enough congeniality to get on with each other as the guardian class. So when you realize that priests, even in the Christian era, took over from the old mystery religion boys when it came to mating up kings and queens and rulers by the same technique of going through their genealogies for certain traits, then they could pretty well, as Plato said, like a good, well-bred dog, he said, you could actually breed the qualities into a person and their offspring that you wanted. And so if you got someone who was a bit too weak or too kind, you would not let them be king. So you would breed them again and then get the perfect one, the one who was aggressive, the perfect type of Alexander, for instance, who would go and enjoy killing and slaughtering and yet still have a fairly high intellect. So this is the guardian class that he was talking about. He then went on to say there'll be a helper class around them who could be drawn from the lower classes, which he called the its. The lower classes in his day were simply called the its. You were a non-person. You were a thing. You were classed amongst the lowest animals. And he talked about the method, the need to breed them the same way for specialized tasks and specialized functions. If you wanted people to be miners, you would breed them small and squat, and you'd match them up with wives that were the same. You would make sure that they had good health, they were strong and robust, and could withstand the dampness in the mines and the conditions. And they actually did that. They bred people the same way as you would breed animals for specific tasks, by mating them up. And in the world to come that he talks about, he said eventually no one will be allowed to marry in the it class, the lower classes, without specialized permission. He said we shall selectively breed the types that we need. And isn't it strange that here we are today, where the science has been pushing so hard through genetic engineering to get to that very step. But I hear the bell, and I believe we're going to take a break for a minute. I think that an ad will be coming on now to tell you about sending your donations to Jackie. And I'll talk to you later after the break.
You're listening to FirstAmendmentRadio.com worldwide. Freedom is never free. We need your support today at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
If you'd like to get a copy of this program, there are a few ways that we can help you. You may subscribe at FirstAmendmentRadio.com for only $45 a month, and you'll receive an MP3 CD weekly of all of our programs. As a bonus, we'll send you a password for our audio archives online. That's a $15 value. Or you may request any month of any program on one MP3 CD for a minimum donation of only $25, or any single program on tape, MP3 CD, or CD for only $15. You may do all of this online at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Just follow the instructions to make a donation or subscribe. Don't do internet? Then call 559-781-3773 and we'll be honored to help you. Thank you from all of us here at FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Roll away the dough.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
Yes, well, I'm back, folks, and I'd like to reiterate that call there for donations for the show, because I think Jackie's got the only show out there which is listener-sponsored entirely. And I think there's a truism that you can never take sponsorship from any company or corporation without some sort of how would we say it? There's a compromise always made, and most of those on shortwave today are heavily financed and backed by companies who sell products, various products, generally fear-based products which you buy in emergencies and so on, and that is their outlet, is a fear-based station or program which cries horror and terror all the time. It's good for business, and people could do that, but Jackie has decided not to, because there are moralistic questions involved here. Is it right to make people so afraid and then have them buy your products out of fear? We should really think about these things. And Jackie doesn't want to compromise what her, she has to say by bringing in a big partner. So I hope you remember to send your donations in. And Jackie's address again is Jackie Petrou, and that's P.O. Box 190, Millerton, Pennsylvania, and the code is 16936. That's Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, 16936, Pennsylvania. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me, I'm putting out three booklets which explain this ancient history right up to the present time. I explain how the societies have been involved in the creation of religions, all religions, and how they manage societies through mind control, basically, and that's what religion was always used for, still is. It doesn't matter what religion you're actually in. And anyone who wants these three booklets can send me $25 for each one. And my address is Alan Watt, W-A-T-T, Site 41, that's S-I-T-E, 41, Box 4, Estaire, which is Estaire, Ontario, Canada, and the postal code is P for Peter, 3, E for Elizabeth, 4, N for Nora, 1. That's Alan Watt, Site 41, Box 4, Estaire, Ontario, Canada, P for Peter, 3, E for Elizabeth, 4, N for Nora, 1. And plus, anyone who wants to phone me is welcome to do so. It's 705-695-0416. Now, if we get back to what we were saying there about these amazing long genealogical lineages going back all the way back to Sumer, which tells us obviously that Sumer was not the beginnings of civilization. It simply resumed that type, the system, I call it, of civilization from a previous civilization. We know that 6000 BC and before, there were other trading groups called the Harappians, who traded all the way from India and all through the Middle East. These Harappians, whose cities are still digging up, lived very well. They were definitely traders, very wealthy. They had hot and cold running water going through their buildings. They lived better than many people of today live, in fact. And I think these simply transposed eventually into the Sumerian culture, because when the Sumerians sprang up, they did not learn or evolve in their system. It was already established from all the different priesthoods, who were also bureaucrats. They were specialized bureaucrats or priesthoods. They had a moneyed system, a weights and measure system. They had receipts, which you could use at the local market, and they'd bake it for you in clay in 15 minutes. They had a whole system of taxation, right to death taxes, in Sumer, 5000 BC. So nothing really has changed terribly in this system. If we look at Charles Galton Darwin, who was the grandson of Charles Darwin, and this particular Darwin was a physicist working in England in the 1950s, and in his book that he put out called The Next Million Years, he goes through this system. He said quite openly and honestly, he said that every system in civilization, and that's the key, they're talking about their system, which is called civilization, every system has been based on a form of slavery. And he said, what we are creating now in the 1950s is a more perfect form of slavery, where the average person will be unaware that they are actually a slave. And this was to be done so gradually and carefully, and through various taxations, etc., and the burgeoning of bureaucracies, that the public would slowly, step by step, simply accept it. They would never really think about it. And once it was in place, it's almost impossible for most people to actually go back and find out how all this started. It was so subtle and gradual. But that's what they're talking about. They took their basis for a slave system in Charles Galton Darwin's book. He took it from the serfdom of England. Now, England being England doesn't like to use the word slave. So when the Normans took over in the 1266, they created a serfdom, which is a slave system for the inhabitants. And the serf was bought and sold with the land for hundreds of years afterwards. The serf technically owned nothing. The little farmhouse that he lived in was not his, it belonged to the lord, but he had to grow all of the lord's wheat or corn, and he would be left with about 60% in non-intensive farming, remember, 60% of his labor, his corn, was kept to himself and to feed his family and his helpers. 40% went to the Lord, which he generally sold most of. Now, when you work out the taxation system today, it's quite amazing to find out that through direct taxation and hidden taxes, the average Joe is paying 40% or more in taxes. So we are serfs and slaves, only we're better at it. We are self-maintained. The slave master doesn't have to throw his clothes or shoes or hire thugs to watch us. They simply train us that we're free and tell us that, and then we work ourselves, and what's left, we actually feed ourselves and clothe ourselves and buy vehicles to get to work, plus all the licenses and insurance it takes to do that. So he was quite right that we are living in a more sophisticated form of slavery. And when we jump back again in time to Plato, because this Plato, out of all of the mystery philosophers, wrote much more about this system that was to come. He said within, outside of the guardian class, the helping class would be consisting mainly of a military, a hereditary military. And he said, towards the end, we will bring females into the military, and eventually these females will breed with the soldiers, and they will have an intergenerational army who will know nothing except what they're taught in the military, and they will be apart from the civilian population. And of course, now we're getting to the end of the whole thing, and we see that happening today, where they've already vanquished the differences between male and female. The women are emulating the males, and of course we're finding more and more of these army people marrying each other and having offspring who then become members of the military. So they are training people and breeding them exactly the same way that Plato said they would. And towards the end, when they have the whole world system in place, Plato talked about reductions of population by various methods, including disease, to reduce the excess, which would no longer be required. And he said eventually they will have their utopia run by the guardian class, who were technically a scientific elite. And he called it the natural aristocracy, the same term that you'll find that Thomas Jefferson used, because he was an Illuminatus himself. They believed that they, being the well-educated scientific types, had the right to dominate those less intelligent or uneducated and run the world through scientific means. And that also meant running the people the same way, forbidding certain ones to breed, perhaps sterilizing others. And this is almost where we are at today. Almost all of the program has been implemented. And Plato said eventually those who will be left, he was talking about the lower its, you might say, would simply live with a duty to serve the state. That will be your only function, a duty to serve the state. From there, we jump into the Rockefeller Foundation and all the other foundations, and they're pouring out propaganda about the New World Order and what it's supposed to be. And my goodness, it's along the line of Plato. No excess population. You will not be born unless they have a job to put you into. And they also talk about the specialization through breeding for specialized tasks. Now we're hearing that the future laborer is going to be a cyborg, part machine, definitely will be unable to think for themselves, because they will have chips installed, which will be connected to regionalized computers, which will direct their work for them. And this is all pretty well out in the open for anyone who wants to look at it now. It's called social Darwinism. It's the perfect society for the elite, where they don't have to use media, novels and nice stories to persuade us to go along in a certain direction. They simply will have the right to make us go along in the direction they want, and leading eventually to the annihilation of individualism. Individualism is the great enemy. That's why they want to destroy that part of the brain, as they've said in so many writings, that gives you your ability of being an individual, of even perceiving yourself amongst others as a distinct living entity. They want to destroy that through chemical means and various other means. Arthur Koestler, who worked for the United Nations on this very project of how to lobotomize that part of the brain, which he called primitive, but it's the part of the brain that gives you all of your individual survival capabilities. He says, how do we destroy this to get world peace? He said, should we put drugs in their water, which will attack that part of the brain? Should we put it in their drinking supply or their food supply? Or, he said, spray them from the air. And my goodness, what do we find? They're doing all of them. Inoculations, of course, were also mentioned, because inoculations can just like biological warfare, they can target specific parts of the brain and literally burn them out. Now, Charles Galton Darwin, in his book again, The Next Million Years, tells us that the elite themselves, the scientific elite, the natural aristocracy, will of course leave themselves unaffected. They will not be lobotomized, he said, because it will destroy the survival capabilities of anyone who is. And since they are the elite who will be guiding the planet, he said, we will need to retain all those faculties. And so those women and men who they have deemed to belong to the natural aristocracy, the super scientific elite, will remain unharmed. And of course the food that they will be given will be, it won't be modified, genetically modified, as has been given to everyone else today. Now this might sound shocking to people. It is the bad news. Of course it is, because you have to look at the bad news to see what can be done about it, even for yourself. And that is the key to it. You can't start off a movement to try and save the world. You'll find most people don't really care, or they're too far gone already with their inoculations and their lifestyle, and they're buying of the fast foods and so on in the cans of the modified stuff. You have to save yourself, first of all, so you can think more clearly, and you must try and get those around you to do the same. People who can grow their own foods should be doing it. Because when you see that Monsanto has a subsidiary company called Sierra, and Sierra company is a pharmaceutical company specializing for many, many years in psychotropic drugs for the psychiatric industry. Now, when the two of them are working together to make your food, alarm bells should be going off. And you see, why would a company who specializes in various kinds of tranquilizers and antipsychotic drugs be in bed with these other guys to make our food? Now, that's a simple, basic question that everyone should ask. And they should really know the answer before they ask it, because it's obvious. Plants have grown drugs in the past. India, thousands of years ago, had a huge slave population who lived on soma, the drug soma, produced by a plant. We're talking really about opium. And plants are famous for creating certain drugs. Now, when Monsanto spends years swapping genes from various species of animals, insects, and even humans to put them into these plants, these modern plants, coupled with a psychiatric producing firm or a drug producing firm, it's rather obvious that these modified foods are also producing certain drugs. And these drugs are affecting people who are losing memory. More and more people are losing short-term memory of all ages. So you have to keep yourself alive and in peak condition as possible by eating natural foods, which you have to grow yourself or get from someone that you know has natural seed. And you can, there are some companies out there, which I'm sure Jackie will tell you about when she comes back on the show, as to where you can send for companies which sell natural seed, the seed that has not been altered, as far as anyone knows. Canada found out 5 years ago, by accident, that the Canadian population were the test rats for the modified food. And we got the news from England. And it turned out the government of Canada had entered and admitted this to secret deals with Monsanto to test the modified stuff on the Canadians. Now, the Canadians here have a national healthcare system, so all your healthcare goes into central databases in Ottawa, so they can see immediately what health effects are causing on the public. So it's a great way of taking data, you see, on your experiment. And since the government admitted, finally under pressure, that we've been eating this modified food for 10 years, and since governments always lie, you could probably stretch that to 20 years. So we see the effects around us. Those who are awake can see the sluggishness of the minds of Joe Average. It isn't their fault. You can't blame them. They've been inoculated with God knows what, and we can't find out actually what they have been inoculated with. They're eating stuff that's scientifically designed to slow them down mentally. They're not reacting to anything really, such as the gas prices skyrocketing. You're looking at a population that's been tranquilized. And then we find out all the spraying that's going on is adding to that. So we are in the middle of a war, and it's a war primarily of the mind. This is the last war. It's the war for the mind. And when the mind goes, any other war is gone. Forget it. The war for your spirit or anything else goes with it. So I'd advise those who can start a regime of healthy eating for themselves, by finding out who's selling organic foods, real organic foods. They go out and do it and start it, because you cannot waste time on this. When your mind goes, you go. Now, this has been a rush in this hour to put out so much, but the point was, a system was developed and put into operation, a plan was hatched thousands of years ago to take over the world. The rabbis claim it was about four and a half thousand BC that this great plan came down, as they called it, and was set into motion. The Greeks said the same thing, and therefore the reference to Prometheus as a symbol of this great light or plan coming down to the high initiates, who would put it into motion, and they hoped to have it all in place by what they called the Age of Aquarius, which we are now entering into now. And the Age of Aquarius, they said, would for the people have it would be a sign of peace, love, and understanding. But of course, the elites knew it for its deeper meaning, which is as Aquarius throws out the old water from his bowl, it's the sea of life he's talking about, it's the gene pool. And of course the old man gets thrown out as they bring in the new. That's what it really means. and we are living it at that time when we're about to embark upon the next phase, which can be introduced very easily if you're ready to do it, of enhancing genes, as you'll say, and then giving us a completely cloned human being who they will say is much superior intellectually and otherwise. They are creating what the Christians would call the Antichrist, you might say. Someone who believes he is godlike, and he certainly will have an incredible intelligence. He'll be charming enough to fool most people, and because the media will build him up to this stardom status, the public will believe that we should follow this guy. This guy's got all the answers. But there won't be just one of them. There'll be many of them. And unfortunately, the public generally fall for the massive propaganda when they create this type of Superman, you might call it. So be aware that this is all underway. Meetings have been held, world meetings have been held over many years about this very time we're living in, and the strategies were all laid down. Thousands of think tanks work on them all the time, and we are about to see it come into effect, and we are about to take the brunt, and we are the ones who have to be able to speak out and inform those who are uninformed as to what's really going on. So it's not all black or hopeless. There are people out there who do understand what must be said openly. And we must also accept there will be a backlash against anyone who can put over their knowledge to those who have none. This will definitely come. But that's almost where we'll have to conclude tonight, I think, because we're up against the bell. And tomorrow night, Jackie will be back with you, refreshed, I'm sure. And we'll take it from there. So thanks for listening tonight. And once again, my name is Alan Watt. And I've given my phone number, so you can call me if you want to phone me or write. And I thank you very much for listening. Good night, folks.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the internet at firstamendmentradio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, PA 16936. Be sure to visit the SweetLiberty.org website.